Hi, I'm Michael McKenzie. Welcome to RN First Bite, a program about food. And today, a look at why sometimes food gets the better of us. World Health Organization data released this week shows global obesity levels doubled between 1980 and 2008. Today, 500 million people, or 12% of our global population, are considered obese, leading to greater risks of diabetes, heart disease, and also some cancers. Most of us know what and how much we should eat and how much exercise we need. So why is the world getting fatter? And what's the role of our minds in all this? To answer some of those questions, we revisit a story first broadcast on All in the Mind last year. Stay with us as Corinne Podger investigates the psychology of obesity.
I've just got home from work and I'm hungry. There's rice in the cupboard. I've got some chicken and a bit of broccoli. I could do a stir fry. I fancy something sweet though. There's some fruit, including the world's most expensive banana. But at the back of the cupboard, right at the back, is a block of chocolate. I know, chocolate's not dinner. We all know, because the healthy lifestyle message isn't that complicated. Watch your calorie intake, get some exercise, don't live on chocolate. Job done, right?
Wrong.
Their bodies become part of their whole persona. And so it helps them to define themselves to be large, and even it prevents them from confronting other issues like their sexuality if they're large.
The flesh we occupy is, in a very real sense, who we are, fat, thin, or in between. Psychologist Marita McCabe's studies in the fields of obesity and sexuality have made some unexpected connections here.
And we found that with some of the women, as they started losing weight, that was pretty terrifying for them to be now seen by their partners and by other men as being sexual beings. That was pretty terrifying for them, because that changed the balance of their interactions with other people. And so instead they put their weight back on again.
Because if you suddenly slim down, presumably your partner might be frightened that you might run off with somebody else.
Absolutely. And with this very early study that we did 30 years ago on obese women, the partners got very concerned as the women started losing the weight. I mean, the women started moving differently. They were dressing differently, moving differently, throwing their heads around differently. And that was very threatening for the partners. And so they would be then getting rewards for their women for losing the weight. And, you know, here's a nice cake that I got for you, or a block of chocolate that I got for you because you were doing so well. And so weight is not just a simple, am I underweight, am I normal weight, am I overweight, am I obese. It represents us. And to change that means to change my being. You would think that it's a very clear process. Reduce your calories, increase your physical activity, and you will lose weight, and you will be healthier, you will be happier, your self-esteem will increase, you will have better levels of body dissatisfaction. Seems so straightforward.
But as we know, nothing in life is ever straightforward.
The challenge is that we're trying to achieve those goals in an environment that's encouraging us, very strongly encouraging us, to be inactive and to eat more energy than we actually need.
There are biological factors that predispose people to being obese, but that was so in the past as well. And so why do we now have so much higher levels of obesity? And this is where the psychosocial factors come in.
There's some really mixed messages out there culturally. So being thin is the cultural ideal, and yet most of our social interactions involve food in some kind of way. So in the same sitting, you can be talking to your friend about how you're trying to control your weight and convincing each other to share a piece of chocolate cake.
Dr. Leah Brennan at Monash University's Centre for Obesity Research and Education. She's also the psychology chair on the Australian and New Zealand Obesity Society, or ANZOS. And before her, Deakin University psychologist Professor Marita McCabe. It's bleak news. Despite 40 years of prodigious effort and expense, we're getting fatter. According to Professor Sue Byrne, a psychologist at the University of Western Australia, study after study has found 80% of everyone who goes on a diet will lose less than 10% of their body weight. And within 5 years, they'll be back where they started or heavier.
It's very, very difficult to not become overweight in our current environment, and it's even more difficult to lose weight and even more difficult again to maintain a new lower weight once you've lost weight.
What you're suggesting, what you're saying, sounds as though it's a battle that isn't even worth fighting.
Well, there is certainly that argument has been made. We do have a responsibility to give people realistic expectations of what's the outcome of any treatment for obesity might look like. So we medical people do that all the time. They say, you know, if you have lung cancer, you've got a, you know, 5% success rate or chance of remission or whatever. But with obesity, I don't think we do that very well, because most people who come in for treatment for obesity expect to lose a lot more weight than we know that they're going to be able to lose. And there is the argument or the question that, is it ethical to say to people that we have treatments for obesity that work when there's no evidence they actually do work, particularly in the long term? At the moment, the best treatment for overweight and obesity is surgery. It seems to be the only treatment where people can lose a significant amount of weight, you know, a lot of weight, half their excess body weight or more, and keep that off. But of course, surgery comes with risks, and it's not really a solution for the entire overweight population. Only a few people can afford to have surgery for a start, and it wouldn't be viable as a treatment solution for everybody.
From Dr. Leah Brennan's office, you can see the Melbourne suburb of Richmond, which is home to the company that runs Weigh It Up, an online weight loss program. Several members agreed to come in for a chat to explain why giving up isn't an option for them.
5 years ago, I got injured and had to have numerous back surgeries. Throughout the course of that, my weight just ballooned out as well. Now that I'm getting back on track, I needed to try and get my weight back down. It was hard to try and find clothes again to fit into. And then when, you know, photos were taken, you just like close your eyes, didn't want to look at how you looked and so on.
I've got a mild kidney issue and blood pressure, and I'm going to see the specialist. She was saying to me that we need to monitor you and you'd have to have a 24-hour blood pressure monitor. I'm actually a practice nurse, so I knew what that meant. And I knew that if I'd continued putting on weight, that was only just going to get worse.
Because I really want to start a family, and I really want to get up and go to a concert and go to the football and just watch a football match and be able to sit in the seat and not encroach on somebody else. And I just don't want to die early.
Online dieters Nick, Anna and Lynn aren't interested in the 80% who fail. They want to hear about the others, the one in five who managed not just to lose weight, but to keep it off. And it's Dr. Leah Brennan's research focus too. She's about to publish a literature review of dozens of weight loss programs, everything she could find in the English language, looking at why people drop out, with a view to encouraging more to stay the course.
We don't know very much about why it is that people don't complete a weight loss intervention. We do know that rates are very high, so up to about 30% is sort of expected in terms of weight loss attrition. Unfortunately, to date, the research is largely focused on demographic factors and other really basic things like how old you are and what gender you are, to see whether they predict whether or not you'll finish. And they're not particularly strong predictors. When we start looking at more complex predictors like psychological factors and social factors, we start to find that there's a little bit more information there. So the clearest predictors are around mental health issues and people who were dealing with mental illness such as depression or an eating disorder were more likely to drop out of a weight loss program.
In fact, it's been suggested that the obesity epidemic that we have is partly a symptom of an underlying stress epidemic or depression epidemic. What was your view on that, having carried out this literature review?
There certainly is growing interest and growing evidence in the relationship between mental health and weight. So the two areas that the literature is really focusing on at the moment is stress and depression. We're in the early stages, but so far what it's showing us is there are some common physiological factors that might mean that each of those disorders are contributing to obesity, and back the other way, that perhaps obesity is contributing to stress and depression as well.
Now, that begs the $64,000 question, obviously, which is, if you're looking at the studies where people are most likely to drop out, what did that have to say about approaches to weight loss where people were most likely to stay the course, the lowest number of dropouts?
terms of trends in the literature, if you're doing a more comprehensive intervention with more support from health professionals and also from others in a similar situation or from family and friends, you're more likely to be able to sustain your weight loss efforts.
Does that suggest that signing up to a support group is a good thing in terms of a predictor of staying the course?
The research is more around, I guess, recruiting other people in your life to provide social support. So whether that be a health professional that's helping you in a structured kind of way to lose weight, or whether it be involving your partner or a friend to be supportive of your weight loss efforts, people that engage other people to help them out are more likely to sustain their efforts.
Support, or the lack of it, rings plenty of bells for Nick, Jenny and Lynn.
My main issue is family. Cooking for teenagers, they don't like all the food on the program, and then you've got to cook two separate meals, and when you've got time constraints with work, that's not always an option.
Yeah, my portions are much bigger than what they should be, and I know that I don't take particularly well to a set diet because I'm still the main cook in the family and I've got three big adult males to contend with.
I'm sabotaged. Other people walking up to me, like an auntie of mine who said, Nick, you know, I prefer you at 250 kilos. You look better to me. I just don't like it when you lose the weight. You just don't look as good.
Now to a crucial conundrum in this story. You might think that losing excess kilos and then keeping them off are part of the same challenge, but in fact research suggests that they're quite distinct, both physically and psychologically. Maintaining your new lower weight is a whole lot harder for surprising reasons, Professor Sue Byrne.
Maintaining a new lower weight is highly effortful. You really, really have to work at it. There's a big difference between physiologically between someone who has always been 80 kilos and someone who was 150 kilos and has lost down to 80 kilos. Because your body, remember, is programmed to defend a higher weight, so it will be doing everything it can to make it easy for you to regain weight. Your metabolism will be much slower. You'll have higher levels of leptin, lower levels of ghrelin, which tend to mean that the drive to eat is very strong and that you tend to not feel full even though you've eaten a lot. And if the person, I guess, perceives that the effort isn't worth it, they're not even happy with that weight anyway, they're highly likely to give up and to abandon efforts at weight control and weight maintenance.
And what's more, maintaining your weight takes unusual staying power. Leah Brennan.
With other health behaviour changes, we do find that people get to a point where they no longer have to put in the same amount of conscious effort in order to maintain their behaviour. Whereas with weight, because of the environmental pressures that are there, it's sort of a lifelong battle that you always are required to put in the conscious effort to maintain health behaviours in an environment that pressures you to be unhealthy.
They are very different processes, and most diets and slimming clubs and so on really only focus on weight loss. And the implication is that people just have to keep on going on losing weight until they get to some sort of ideal weight, whatever that might be. Then there's no focus on, you know, what to do when you get there, or even on trying to maintain a higher weight than you might initially have wanted.
One of the interesting findings from one of your research studies runs completely counter to the way that many of us conceptualise weight loss, which is that people who are actively trying to lose weight at the same time as maintain what they've lost are at the most risk of putting it all back on again. Why was that?
I think the main issue here is that most people come into some sort of treatment program for overweight with an unrealistic idea about the amount of weight they can achieve during treatment. So, for example, most female would come in for treatment, her weight would be 105 kilos, and when you would ask her, so what weight would you like to achieve by the end of this treatment? They would say 65 kilos. Obesity research has been around since the 1960s, and there's been hundreds of treatment trials of behavioural treatments and drug treatments are trying to get people to lose weight. And we know that, you know, at best, people are going to lose, hopefully, between 5 and 10% of their body weight. So for someone weighing 105 kilos, that's about 10.5 kilos, so they'll end up being 90 kilos and not 65. What happens then is people get very despondent about it. They think, well, I'm not nowhere near where I want to be, and this is all really hard, and even losing that much weight was so difficult, and they sort of give up. You know, they think, what's the point? I'm not happy where I am, so I may as well go back to, you know, what I was doing before.
You need a psychological bang for your buck if you're going to stay on track, and you don't get that when you're just trying to keep your weight steady, psychologist Leah Brennan.
When you're talking about weight loss, you're talking about making large changes to your habits and routines, and you're seeing the benefits of those changes. So you're seeing weight loss and you're experiencing the benefits of that. So changes in clothing sizes, comments from friends, capacity to do things that you couldn't otherwise do. So this constant positive reinforcement coming from your environment in terms of the benefits of your efforts.
Sandra, who's doing the weight loss program we heard about earlier, knows exactly how that feels.
I just think the perception of what other people say and they comment and go, wow, you know, you've lost some weight, and you actually feel quite good. That positive feedback, it does make you feel pretty good inside.
Whereas with weight loss maintenance, that's not quite the same picture, is it?
No, it's quite different. So once your weight stabilises, you're no longer getting those positive reinforces from your environment.
You're listening to RN First Bite and a story that was first broadcast last year on All in the Mind. With all the money being spent on weight loss, why are we getting fatter? Today, Corinne Podger looks at how our minds sabotage us in concert with our bodies.
Is it worth the waiting for if we live till 84? All we ever get is cruel.
At that moment, when you give up on a well-planned weight loss program, what's going on in your head? Well, food, it seems, is a way many of us resolve life's hard problems, as Anna, Nick and Jenny can testify.
Studying at university, not being able to do a physics equation and throwing the physics book from one end of the room to the other, that would be the first thing, and then dumping the diet would be the second thing.
Basically, with the operations and so on that I've been through, there was like a lot of stress going through all of that. Not having any support from work colleagues, there was a lot of stress going on there. No support from family, stress from there as well. A lot of things going on.
The antisocial aspects, including just within my own family, of being the one to have the little tray of stuff and meanwhile cooking proper nice meals for everybody else, and there's a limit to how long you can do that, I think.
And I'm a sweet tooth, so if I get stressed, and I'm not talking major stress like a death of family, I'm just talking a small stress will make me eat. I'm a comfort eater as well, so if the kids were annoying me, if I had a bad day, I basically gave up and was just eating what I wanted to eat.
So let's look at thinking styles as part of this story. Sue Byrne, with British colleagues, has found that people who are better at problem-solving and so coping with stress, including the stress of not losing as many kilos as they'd initially hoped, do better in the weight stakes.
We recruited a whole bunch of people who had managed to lose a significant amount of weight. Most of them were about 20% of their body weight, so they'd lost a lot of weight and were now almost healthy weight or in the healthy weight range and had kept it off for at least 2 years. We also recruited a bunch of people who had lost a lot of weight but had regained all the weight they'd lost within the last 2 years. We also interviewed a group of people who'd never had a weight problem, who'd always been in the healthy weight range and whose weight didn't seem to deviate. We talked to all these people at length, drove around the country interviewing them and trying to get an idea, because we really didn't have any good hypotheses about what people might need to do, you know, psychologically to maintain a new lower weight. The people who were able to lose a lot of weight and keep it off just kept doing all the right things. They were very careful with their diets, they were very active, prioritised their weight and their shape and their fitness, and they invested a lot of time and effort in maintaining a new lower weight. The people who'd regained weight had tended to adopt very strict dietary practices to lose weight. They had sort of developed quite rigid rules about their diet. They either went on sort of liquid diets or very restrictive diets that they weren't able to maintain in the long term. It was almost impossible to keep living like that. And the other interesting factor was to do with expectations about weight loss. The people that were able to maintain weight were happy with losing, you know, a moderate amount of weight. So rather than having some sort of rigid, unrealistic goal weight that you felt like you had to achieve, you people were able to modify their original hopes or expectations about the weight they wanted to achieve and modify it up so that were more flexible about the weight they were happy to be, and therefore more accepting of themselves as people and their bodies at whatever weight they were. Another factor was a type of thinking style, and one that we call dichotomous thinking or black and white thinking. And that is a tendency for people to think in sort of very all or nothing terms. And we found that people who did have that thinking style, who were very black and white or all or nothing thinkers, were much more likely to regain weight. And we figured that it partly had to do with the overlap between this thinking style and having rigid, unrealistic weight goals, so that people who were black and white thinkers and didn't achieve their weight goal were more likely to throw in the towel and say, well, if I can't get there, I may as well not bother at all. Whereas people who were more flexible and were able to say, well, I didn't get to the weight that I really wanted to get to, but this is okay and I'm better off here than where I was before, and so it's worthwhile maintaining, working hard to maintain this weight, we're more likely to be able to do that.
And you might have more luck if you have a clear understanding of why you're doing what you're doing. Another of Leo Brennan's studies has found many of us look to weight loss to solve other problems that have nothing to do with the extra kilos.
We started with working through what was already in the literature and also talking to a range of clinicians who'd worked with people trying to lose weight to identify a very long list of reasons people give for wanting to lose weight. So I think we started with something like 170 different reasons that people gave for trying to lose weight. Then we set up a questionnaire, which we then administered to 127 people who were overweight and actively trying to lose weight, and from that we were able to identify the key themes that came out in terms of people's underlying sort of primary goals for weight loss.
Some of those goals were physical in nature, for example wanting to reduce joint pain, wanting to avoid swollen legs, get rid of back pain. Some of it was very much about the psychological. I want to be attractive, I want to have more confidence, to get ahead in my work. What sorts of goals were helpful for people that kept them focused?
What the theory predicts is that people actually need to be working towards achieving those goals directly, that often those goals are not weight dependent, so you don't have to lose weight in order to feel more self-confident, and sometimes they're not even weight related, so losing weight doesn't necessarily mean that you'll find a new partner. So perhaps weight loss intervention should also incorporate helping people to achieve those other goals, and perhaps we're doing it around the wrong way. If we were helping people to achieve those other goals, they then might be more motivated to maintain their weight loss efforts. Whereas if they're continuing to rely on weight loss in order to achieve those goals and never quite getting there, then it's hard to sustain the motivation.
Cognitive behavioural therapy, or CBT, targets unhelpful thoughts and can help us reconfigure them. So does it have a role then in stopping our minds sabotaging our diets?
What we found was that, as we expected, the people who were in the behaviour therapy, traditional behaviour therapy group, and the people that were in the cognitive behaviour therapy group lost a modest amount of weight on average, around about 5 to 10% of their initial body weight, which we actually know is clinically significant. You get really good medical benefits even from losing that small amount of weight. However, what we also found over the next 5 years was that everyone regained weight at the same rate. So basically we failed to find a better treatment for overweight, for maintaining a new lower weight, even though we gave it our best shot.
That's depressing.
So basically what we found is that people tend to regain weight. The vast majority of people will regain all the weight they lost within 3 to 5 years.
People don't enjoy doing the same thing over and over again and failing at it. Is there a psychological cost to repeatedly failing to lose weight?
That's a really good question, and that's one that I don't think we really know the answer to yet, because there is a psychological cost to losing weight and regaining and losing weight and regaining. You know, that yo-yo dieting or weight cycling, it's sometimes called, is associated with poor self-esteem and depression. The rate of depression in people who are overweight or obese is a lot higher than in the general population, especially among females. So the question is, would it be better, both medically and psychologically, for people to never try to lose weight, you know, to maintain an overweight status, as opposed to going through cycles of losing weight but regaining it and losing and regaining? And I don't think we know the answer to that question yet.
Every time I basically lose hope, sure, I mourn for about 5 minutes, but the pants that I'm currently wearing, I couldn't wear 2 months ago. And, you know, when I first put them on, it triggered memories of, getting dressed up and going out on a Saturday night or a Friday night, things that I couldn't do on at 250 kilos, I feel like the Nick that I consider to be the true Nick.
The true Nick, speaking to Corin Podger, as was Professor Sue Byrne before him and others. And a big thank you to Corin and also to Natasha Mitchell, who co-produced this story. Next week, the flip side, from those who find it hard to control their eating to those for whom food is a mortal enemy. We'll meet New Yorker John Reiner, whose memoir, The Man Who Couldn't Eat, takes us into his world where doctors sentenced him to nil by mouth and the impact that has on his body, his family, and ultimately his mind.
I literally went to make myself lunch, a tuna fish sandwich. I was looking forward to it and felt a little twinge in my gut. Went to the toilet and never really got up in one piece again. As I came to live without food, its importance not only for my health and my sustenance, but my sense of identity became greater. I realized how much food had played a part in the important events of my life and also dictating to a large degree who I am.
That's next week on RN First Bite. I'm Michael McKenzie. Catch you then.